Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Wednesday, the 2nd of June, Rebecca Skloot is our guest this hour. She has written one fascinating book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Doctors took her cells without asking. Those cells never died. They launched a medical revolution and a multi-million dollar industry. More than 20 years later, her children found out and their lives would never be the same. Actually, how Rebecca came to this story is quite interesting as well. She looked at a photo on her wall, and we'll hear this story rounded out in just a moment. The woman in the photograph, Henrietta Lacks, with a code name Hela, the world's first immortal human cells, cut from her cervix just months before she died. She spent years staring at the photo, wondering what kind of life she led, what happened to her children, what she'd think about the cells from her cervix living on forever, bought, sold, packaged, and shipped by the trillions to labs all over the world, went up even in the first space missions to see what would happened to human cells in zero gravity, and helped with some of the most important advances in medicine, the polio vaccine, chemotherapy, cloning, gene mapping, in vitro fertilization. There are trillions more of her cells growing in labs now than there ever were in her body. This is also a compelling story because it brings in medical ethics. It deals with issues of race and poverty and how hospitals treated poor black women. Even fairly advanced places like Johns Hopkins back in the early 1950s. Rebecca is an award-winning science writer. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, O, the Oprah Magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, and elsewhere. This is her first book, and I don't even know if she knows this, but UW-Madison announced in April that Rebecca's book is the second book for Go Big Read, the university's common reading program. There were 160 unique titles nominated, and her book will be the big read next year for a number of reasons, which is a big deal. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, aren't you glad? I know it was an ordeal to write this book, but it was meant to be, wasn't it? It was meant to be from your going to that biology class when you were in high school, and look what happened as a result of that.
Yeah, it does sort of feel like my life has been moving toward this moment for a long time, and Henrietta's family, at some point, eventually decided that she had sort of, in a sense, been guiding my life, working me like a puppet since I was about 15. You know,
and you may believe there's some truth to that at this point, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is a fascinating story, as I was saying, on so many levels, because it's her contributions to science were enormous. But I found the race issues and the poverty issues and the issues of spirits and her cells living on and the family not knowing and the ethical issues. There is so much to this story.
Yeah, which, is one of the reasons why it took me about 11 years to write. it is. It's such a complicated story, and weaving them all together in a way that, one of my big goals with the book was to sort of not demonize the scientists and to show that the story is really about the human beings behind everyone involved in the story. And so, it took quite a while to work all that out.
Right. Well, let's start with the story of Henrietta Lacks, because I found that really interesting, too, the way hospitals treated people back in those years, the racism that was pretty evident, even though Johns Hopkins was a fairly enlightened place.
Yeah, it was, when she went to Johns Hopkins, this was during the era of Jim Crow, and, segregation was law, and she went to Hopkins because there really wasn't anywhere else for her to go. She's lucky that it happened to be a very good hospital, but she was only allowed to go to hospitals that saw black patients. So she was in a colored ward. She was operated on in a colored operating room. When she died, she was put in the colored freezer. I mean, it was incredibly segregated. And the people who generally ended up in these public wards at Hopkins, which was where there was free treatment, were either black or poor or both, and she really was both.
And tell us a little bit more about her life. She was a tobacco farmer, the circumstances of where she lived, et cetera, and how she discovered that there was something wrong.
Yeah, she was 30 years old, and she was a tobacco farmer who had grown up on the same farm where her family, you know, had farmed as slaves. And she was living in Baltimore at the time. They had moved up there, she and her husband, and they had five kids. They'd moved there so he could work in the shipyards. And she had some abnormal bleeding between her periods, and she just sort of knew there was something wrong. And she went into her bathtub, she went into her bathtub and just sort of slid her finger up inside of herself and felt this tumor on her cervix, which, to this day, it's sort of a bit of a mystery what made her do that, how she knew to go look for it. But she did, and she found it and went to the doctor and said, she called it a knot. She said, I've got a knot on my womb, and, I think the doctor has to take a look. And they did, and they took a small biopsy, and it came back as cervical cancer. And then in what was kind of standard practice for the day, she came back to the hospital for radium therapy, which was they would take tubes of radioactive material and sew those to the surface of the cervix and leave them there for a few days to essentially burn off the cancer. And they did this under anesthesia. And while she was without her knowledge and before treating her cancer, her doctor just cut this little extra piece of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And Guy had been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades, but it had never worked. He could get them to live for a few days, maybe, but then they would die. And no one knows exactly why, but hers just never did. So they just took off and almost immediately began doubling their numbers every 24 hours.
And the number of cells that they got from this is just phenomenal.
It really is. It's sort of impossible to wrap your mind around it.
Yes.
So there's one scientist calculated that if you could have saved all of the cells that ever grew from that one little sample, and I mean the piece they took was smaller than a dime. So if you could have saved all the cells that grew from that one little tiny sample, that by this point they would weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is more than 150 Empire State Buildings. And cells weigh almost nothing. So it's inconceivable how many of these cells grew. And part of that is because soon after they grew, scientists began using them for all sorts of research. I mean, you mentioned in the introduction, they were used to help develop the polio vaccine, went up in the first space missions. They were the first cells ever cloned, first genes ever mapped. I mean, it just goes on and on. And to keep up with the demand for cells in research labs, a factory was set up at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, where they began mass producing her cells in these enormous vats of liquid culture medium, which is like the food that they eat. And they grew them to the tune of about 6 trillion cells a week. And they would send those to labs around the country. And so it was just this enormous production.
It sure was enormous production. Is it, you mentioned something that got me wondering, is it important and would it be important scientifically to know why these particular cells multiplied the way they did? Is that important for science? Is anybody trying to figure that out?
It is, yeah. And I mean, this is a question that I get often when I go and I give talks about the book or something. People say, well, why her cells and why do they grow like this? And the irony is that, scientists know so much about HeLa cells and the way they behave, and they're these intensely studied cells, but nobody really knows exactly why they grew and no other cells did. And, I often talk in front of groups of scientists, and there's usually this moment where they look at each other and they're like, we don't know that? Why don't we know that? We should know that. And so there are actually some scientists that are trying to get me a better answer to that question. At this point, they don't really know. I mean, they know that she had HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer, and that her cells have multiple copies of the DNA from that. And so they think, well, maybe there was something about her having multiple copies of this virus. She also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause a cancer to grow more aggressively. But so did a lot of other people, particularly in the 50s, and their cells didn't grow like this. And the other thing that's interesting is that cervical cancer cells turn out to be some of the hardest ones to grow. So it's all a little bit of a mystery. And the cancer grew as intensely in her body as it did in the lab. So, she was 30 when she was diagnosed, and within about 7 months, this little tumor that was about the size of a nickel had spread to almost every organ in her body.
And she was in agony. You can just feel that pain through your writing.
Yeah, her death was very painful, and recreating that was one of the hardest things I think I've ever done as a writer. It was really, when you sort of bring a moment like that to life, I think it's, I had heard other writers talk about this, but had never experienced it quite in the way I did with writing this. But it was just sort of emotionally and physically very sort of draining and devastating. I think I wrote that, the scene of her death and the sort of decline toward it, over the course of a few days, the first draft of it. And then I just went and laid down, and I think I didn't move for like 3 or 4 days after that. I was pretty devastated, yeah.
Oh, so your life was intertwined with hers, and it must have been when you finally made contact with the family. You almost, I don't want to go with this, except that I have to bring it up. You almost think, as some people did, you know, that Henrietta was born in order to come up with some, and died in order to come up with some cures for these devastating illnesses. You almost have to think that, at least for a fleeting moment, don't you?
There's some element of fate that just sort of intertwines itself through so many different parts of the story. And, you know, for her family, you know, they struggled with, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about that, the knowledge of, you know, what happened to their mother and learning about the cells. And it took her, particularly her daughter Deborah, many, many years to come to a place where she really felt like, in a sense, that Henrietta was brought back to life as an angel, and that maybe she was chosen to cure diseases and to do all of this wonderful stuff for sort of humanity. That did, I think, in a sense, help her daughter in particular feel a bit better about the whole thing.
Right. And that was, we may as well jump to that part of the story. The family didn't know anything for years and years after the cells had become famous and incredibly useful for scientific knowledge. They were not told. It must have been something to know that. I mean, can you imagine that your mother or your aunt or whatever had these cells, and they were, and there were trillions of them, and they were all over the world, and she was still alive in a sense.
Yeah, this was a huge moment for the family. So yeah, when she died, no one told her husband or her kids that the cells were alive, and they just sort of went on with their lives, and they were pretty difficult lives. They lived in some pretty severe poverty in Baltimore, and they really struggled. And she died in 1951, and then in the early 70s, in order to learn more about the cells, some scientists essentially decided to track down her kids and do research on them. And so they called up her husband one day, and he had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was, and the way he understood the call was, we've got your wife, she's alive in a laboratory.
Oh my gosh.
We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your children to see if they have the cancer that killed her. None of which was what the scientist said at all, but you know, he thought they had her in a cell, like a prison cell. That was the only kind of cell he'd ever heard of, and so her family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and the scientists didn't realize that they didn't understand, and it was just sort of one huge communication misfire after another, and it really had some pretty bad effects on her family. Her children in particular, they pretty quickly figured out that she wasn't alive. You couldn't go visit her in the sense that you could before she died, but, you know, for what it meant to have part of her alive in the lab was not at all clear to them, and particularly Deborah, she very much believed her mother's soul was alive in these cells. Yes, the scientists would come to the house and take samples from the kids for research, and she would say things like, you know, can my mother rest in peace if you're shooting these bits of her up to the moon? And if you're injecting them with these chemicals, does that hurt her somehow? And she was very worried about the viral research being done on the cells. You know, they would infect the cells with, you know, polio and everything from polio to AIDS to Ebola, and Deborah would worry horribly that her mother would feel the effects of those diseases somewhere out there, you know, that the side effects and the sort of symptoms of the disease. And she would ask the scientists about this, and they just didn't know how to respond to her. And at one point, one of them gave her a medical school genetics textbook and said, here, read this.
Oh, my goodness.
This will tell you what you need to know. And so for Deborah, a lot of it was this struggle to understand what the cells were, what they meant for her mother. She was very worried that she should be protecting her mother and, you know, doing something about what was being done with the cells. She also really desperately wanted to know who her mother was, and she thought maybe the cells could help her learn about her mother since she was a toddler when she died. And But for her brothers, I mean, they pretty quickly found out that people were buying and selling these cells.
Right.
Yeah, so in addition to all the important science done on them, they were the first ever commercialized. And, you know, we have this multi-billion dollar industry now based on buying and selling cells and tissues and patenting genes. And it all goes back to her cells in the beginning. And, you know, her family to this day can't afford health insurance.
Isn't that something?
And, you know, and they would say things like, if, you know, if our mother was so important to medicine, why can't we go to the doctor? And if people are buying and selling these, you know, where's our cut, essentially? And no one could ever answer that for them. So it started literally just decades of just sort of struggle for the family to understand what these cells were, get some money from all of this. And it kind of never stopped.
And so all of the encounters that they had, particularly with white people, were pretty negative from the scientific community, from the hospital, et cetera. And people were making money. Most of them were white people making money off these cells, which made it fairly difficult for you as an author to gain access to the family, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so when I came along in the late 90s, still no one had told the family what the cells were. And, you know, they had been through sort of one thing after the other. And for them, I was just yet another person, white person, coming along wanting something from them having to do with these cells. And they wanted nothing to do with me. And it took me about a year and a half to convince them to talk to me. And a lot of how I did that was really by sharing information with Deborah. It was pretty clear to me from the, we had one phone call where she was very excited about the idea of a book about her mother. And she kept saying, well, maybe then I can learn about her too. And, but then she also was very, she was sort of terrified, and she said, well, maybe Hopkins sent me to take her cells. And she sort of, there was this incredible mistrust, and it was clear to me from that call that, first of all, that something had happened to the family that I didn't know about. All I knew was that there were these amazing cells, and they came from this black woman that no one seemed to know anything about. And like, I wanted to find out who she was. And but from talking to Deborah, it was clear something had happened to her family, too, that I needed to know about. And also that she was really desperate to know what had happened. So I would, as I did research, you know, into Henrietta's childhood and, you know, her cells and various things, I would call Deborah's house, and she'd call her ID, so she wouldn't answer.
Oh, no.
And I would leave these long messages on her answering machine, you know, saying, like, oh, you know, I found your cousin Cliff, and he told me this great story about your mom when she was a kid. And, you know, I would sort of leave these stories on her answering machine, and eventually she fessed up that she was sort of sitting there over the machine, dying to pick up, but being afraid to pick up, and finally basically just said, okay, fine, I'll talk to you. And one of the things that she said is, you know, I'll talk to you, but you have to promise you'll never hide anything from me, which, you know, I said, I have no intention of hiding anything. You know, you can come with me when I do my research. And so really that becomes part of the book, is Deborah and I travel around sort of trying to learn who her mother was, and it really helped Deborah find some peace with all of it.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you. And here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Rebecca Skloot is our guest. The book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Doctors took her cells without asking. Those cells never died. They launched a medical revolution and a multi-million dollar industry. More than 20 years later, her children found out their lives would never be the same. And Rebecca's book, we wanted to remind you, has been chosen as the Go Big Read, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Common Reading Program. It was a big honor to be chosen. The people who chose this said that the book is cross-disciplinary and relevant and will engage students and readers on a number of intellectual and personal levels, which is very true. It's a gripping story with layer after layer after layer. So you're looking at African Americans' views of the medical system. It includes lots of information about the Tuskegee syphilis incident and women having hysterectomies being used as kind of guinea pigs for this. It looks at the scientific community at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere in the world with the best of intentions trying to advance the cause of science and treat diseases. It deals with poverty, with some people making lots of money from the HeLa cells, Henrietta Lacks cells, and while her family had no health insurance. It deals with just all kinds of issues of race and on it goes. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for some time now. It's well worth a read. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rebecca Skloot is our guest. The book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and we start phone calls with Jennifer from Madison. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I have a question that I was hoping your guest could help clarify for me. You keep referring to these cells from Henrietta's cervix as them being Henrietta, and I guess I'm having a hard time wrapping myself around that because when I think of, you know, the cells from my mouth or cells from my skin, I don't refer to them or perceive them as being me because I am composed of so many more things than just a cell. And so I guess I'm having a hard time making that connection, and I was wondering if your guest could clarify that a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. And a lot of it does depend on your sort of understanding of cells and yourself and all that. And yeah, every once in a while, you know, I don't see my cells as being me. after, you know, 11 years of being with the Lacks family, every once in a while I sort of slip and refer to the cells as she. and, you know, but absolutely for the, you know, for the family, those cells are Henrietta. They know that they're her cancer cells, so they're not even her normal cells. They're essentially the cells that killed her. But, you know, they have Henrietta's DNA inside of them, and because of that, you know, they really are, they're a part of you. And they, you know, they have information about, you know, your cells have information about you, about your children, about your grandchildren. And for her family, you know, and I think for a lot of people out there, that It's very hard to separate that, your DNA from you. So some of it depends on how you sort of view that. And for her children in particular, they really, you know, they believe her soul is alive in there. They believe very much that cells contain a part of you. And so for them, it really wasn't, they really weren't that separate from Henrietta. And they were the only part of her that was living. You know, for Deborah in particular, she had spent so much of her life wishing her mother was alive and wishing, you know, that she could meet her someday. And then to find out 25 years after her mother's death that some of these cells that came from her mother's cervix were still alive, it was like finding out a bit of her mother was alive. And in fact, it was. You know, they did come from her cervix. So, you know, it depends. It's a personal thing. Occasionally, scientists will say to me, "But they aren't her, and they're the thing that killed her. And you know, this isn't. They aren't little bits of her. You know, but they came from her body, and so it's hard to separate those things."
Right. Thanks very much for the call. We go to Bonnie from Hartford next. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I am so excited about this book. I read it twice, and I heard about it first of all on National Public Radio, and I'm an oncology nurse, and I'm also on our hospital investigational review board, which has to do with the informed consent process, which is all wrapped up into the story that you're talking about now with Rebecca. And I was so excited about the story of that's in the book, and the story of this woman and her family and her incredible contribution, that I brought the information to one of the meetings of our investigational review board as part of our ongoing educational process. And they bought the book, and it's making the rounds among the members of the investigational review board right now.
Great.
But it's just an amazing story, and it just blew me away.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I hear, you know, there are these IRBs at every hospital, every research institution, and when I go and give talks, I hear from people on IRBs all the time saying, you know, essentially, thank you for, this gives us a sort of human story that lets us look at the different things that we do every day, in a sense, you know, the different issues that we talk about on IRBs that are sometimes really abstract. And the other thing that I hear often, you know, one of the things that IRBs do is that they're there and deal with informed consent forms and various things like that. And I often hear the history of where IRBs came from is tied to the cells, and it's in the book. And I often hear people say, well, this helps me complain less about having to fill out all these forms to sort of hear where they came from and why we have them. And so thank you. I think it's important to circulate the story.
You spend the latter part of the book talking about many of the ethical issues here, because one of the questions about this was, did anybody have the right to take these tissues from her without her consent? No case law, you write, has fully clarified whether you own or have the right to control your tissues. When they're part of your body, they're clearly yours. Once they're excised, your rights get murky.
Yeah, and this is still something. This is something that people are talking about, you know, a lot now. And this question of how should we be regulating tissue research? And there are some laws. You know, what was done with the family in the 70s when scientists went to them and took the cells samples from them specifically for research? That's something you can't do today without informed consent. That would violate federal law. But once the samples, once cells are removed from you, you know, in a biopsy or routine tests of some kind, and your identity is stripped from them, if they weren't taken just for research purposes, those are often stored and used in research, and people don't really realize that. You know, we sign these forms that say you can dispose of my tissues any way you see fit, and this is what that means. They often go into this world of research, and how those are regulated, like how the research on that is regulated, depends, varies from institution to institution. But there is no kind of standard practice for what, how that should be handled and what people should be told, including, you know, what research is done on the tissues and whether they're going to be commercialized. And so there's a lot of discussion right now going on about that.
Right. You also weave in, and if you could please tell me how Henrietta's family took the news about all that was happening with her cells in the context of what many people in the black community thought of the medical establishment because of things like the Tuskegee syphilis study.
Yeah. You know, there's a long history of African-Americans being used in research without their consent. You know, the Tuskegee syphilis studies are the most, that's the most famous case. This was a case where African-American men with syphilis were studied to essentially watch how syphilis killed you from infection to death. And when treatment became available, penicillin, you know, was discovered to be able to treat it. It wasn't offered to these men, so they were essentially watched. The researchers watched them die without offering them treatment, and this has been long held up as one of the most unethical pieces of research that was done in the United States. And but there are many other cases like that, dating back to the slavery times, you know, when slaves were often used to develop, you know, surgical practices or do various other research. And you know, this is a history that's passed on through generation to generation through oral storytelling, and you know, so it's very much alive in African American communities. The history of what was done, essentially, to black people over the years in the name of science, and there's a lot of mistrust between African Americans and the medical communities because of that. And it's something that, and it's not just African Americans; it's any minorities really. But it's something that scientists struggle with a lot because, you know, African-Americans and other minorities are underrepresented in a lot of research because they're essentially afraid to participate because they don't trust scientists. And that ends up actually being harmful for them because then drugs and things are developed without, you know, sort of them being a part of the process.
Right.
So Henrietta's story has long been sort of tied up within that. And the way it has been passed on through oral storytelling and occasionally magazine articles and things is, you know, this black woman went to the hospital and this, you know, racist white scientist knew her cells were going to be valuable. They stole them from her and he got rich off of them, maybe didn't treat her cancer in order for her cells to grow. And, you know, there's this very sort of terrifying story, and none of that is true. You know, but you can't separate out race from the story. And they were taking samples from any woman who went into Hopkins. They weren't targeting black people, but the majority of people who were seen in this public ward were black people because they were the only, that was the only place they could get treatment. And, you know, the other thing about with the Tuskegee studies, when the family first learned about the cells being alive and they got that phone call saying the cells are alive and we've been doing research on them, it was literally just a few months after the Tuskegee studies hit the press. So there was all this media and, you know, everyone was talking about this research done on black people where, you know, their diseases weren't treated. in the name of science. And then all of a sudden, here's this woman who seemed perfectly healthy when she went to the hospital. Now all these years later, her cells are alive, and what does that mean? And so it got wrapped up in this larger story, at where it's remained ever since.
Hmm. Thank you, Bonnie, so much for your call. Dick in Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. I hope I'm not jumping ahead, but you haven't gotten to the, or at least I haven't heard you mention whether the Lacks family finally got their cut, as was put earlier.
No, they haven't gotten anything from this. That's often one of the first questions I get is, so, okay, has someone given them anything yet? And they haven't. And the reason is there's a concern among scientific research organizations and Hopkins, where this was done, that doing anything for the Lacks family would essentially set a precedent that they are not, they're sort of afraid to set. And they say, if we gave the Lacks family money for this, what about the millions of other people whose cells have been used in research without their knowledge? And, how do we sort of, who gives them money? George Guy, the researcher who grew the cells, just gave them all away for free. He never patented them. He never profited from them. Neither did Hopkins directly. And it was sort of people down the line who made money off of them. And there are many companies out there who sell the cells. You can go online and buy a vial of HeLa cells for about $200 or products made using them up to about $10,000 a vial.
Oh.
But there's this, big question of, well, how much of that is HeLa cells and how much of that is the science that went into it? And, if you had taken Henrietta's cells and just put them, in a dish without doing anything, they would have died. And so the question about doing something for the Lacks family gets sucked up into this larger issue of, who should profit off of biological materials.
Am I still on?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Boy, oh boy, all the scheme that it goes on and how not to let people get their cut.
Well, it's very simple. I mean, this is something that...
We don't pay the real price of anything, do we? Look at all the natural resources, the way we treat them.
Yeah, this is becoming, in some senses, part of the healthcare debate. A lot of the sort of rationale that scientists have often used for taking samples from people and using them in research, and them not profiting is, well, everyone benefits from this. They say, we do research on these tissues, and it's true. This is all very important research, and everyone does want to have it done. But the truth is that not everyone does benefit. Her family doesn't have access to health care.
Right.
This system in which samples are taken from people, often without them realizing it, commercialized and turned into products that are then often sold back to the people the samples came from, and some of those people can't afford it. It's just, a lot of people are saying, well, this is sort of another part of the healthcare system that's essentially broken. And I just wanted to add, in terms of the family, this is something that I struggled with as a writer coming to this, saying, I knew that I could potentially benefit off of this someday if, I was in grad school when I started working on the book, and I thought, well, if it ever gets published. And so one of the things I wanted to be able to do something for the family if that happened. And so I set up, before the book came out, the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. And some of the proceeds from the book go in there and any other sort of future things.
Good for you.
Thank you. And it's, among other things, it's an education fund for scholarship money for descendants of Henrietta Lacks. So they can go to school,
great.
And I hope it will also help them with health care.
Great.
There's a website, and anyone can donate, and it's henriettalacksfoundation.org. And donations come in almost every day from readers and often from individual scientists who have used the cells in their work, and they say, I want to do something for the family. So there is something happening, but I think the family is still very much waiting for a response from the people who've actually potentially profited off of the cells.
Yes. Thank you, Dick, so much for your call.
Get an address for me, will you? I'm computer illiterate.
Oh, okay.
I'll be getting in touch with you, Kathleen.
Okay, Dick.
Yep, thanks.
Yeah,
bye.
Fine. We'll get an address and put it on our Facebook. Oh, no, he's computer illiterate. Can't put it on the Facebook page because he wouldn't see it. We'll just get an address and he
can
call us later.
It's all on the website, henriettalacksfoundation.org. There's a mailing address. Plus, a way to donate online.
And this has really taken off, too. I understand that Oprah's interested and there's going to be a film now?
Yeah, the Oprah and Alan Ball and and HBO are together making a movie of the book, which I'm very excited about. The family's very excited about, and we're all, you know, I'm going to be a consultant on it, and so is the family, and yeah, so that's very exciting. That just happened recently.
Oh, that is great. And did you know this news about your book is being read at Madison next year?
I did. Yes, I am excited, and I'm actually going to be there in October. To talk to the students and to do a bunch of events surrounding the book. So, yeah, I'm really excited about it. I was there as part of my book tour. I gave a talk there and met some of the people who were sort of involved with picking it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Tell us the story, too. The title comes from, as we talk about whether cells are part of a human being and make a person live on, this story of George Guy and what he said to Henrietta over her bed that gave you the title of the book, too.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment in the story because for everyone I talked to who knew George Guy said he never had any contact with her. He didn't ever talk to her. But this one woman who worked with him said, oh, yes, I very distinctly remember he went to her bedside basically as she was dying and said, your cells will live on forever. Your cells will make you immortal, and they're going to help, you know, many people. And, you know, the way that she told the story was that Henrietta said that she was happy about that. She was glad to hear it. And, of course, it's, you know, who knows if it actually happened. I mean, there's no reason she would have made that up. But, you know, even if it had happened, Henrietta probably wouldn't have understood it. I mean, she didn't know what cells were or how immortality would play into any of that. She was also on a lot of medication at the time. But, you know, that I think that moment is important in the story. And the title of the book, really, people often, just sort of in glancing at it, think that the immortal that I'm saying Henrietta is immortal, you know, as a human being. And of course, a lot of that is open to your personal interpretation,
right,
what immortality is and life and all of that. But for me, the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks is essentially the story of the legacy of what happened after she died,
mm-hmm,
both in terms of, you know, for science and also for her family. The book's divided into three sections: life, death, and immortality. And the section of immortality starts the day her family found out that the cells were still alive. So in a lot of ways, that immortal portion is the sort of impact that had on her family.
And I was thinking as I was reading about your encounter with her husband, who was still alive, and the brothers and the all the people who were gathered in the house who had all had these physical ailments, you know, and I was thinking, as you were talking about earlier, why in the world weren't those cells available to help them? But it was because they couldn't go to the doctor. They didn't have insurance. It's just filled with irony, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was something that really that irked the family, you know.
I can see why.
Right. To no end. And, you know, they are. They're plagued with, you know, the same health problems essentially that plague most, you know, inner city African Americans who don't have a lot of money. You know, they have diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease, and you know, and so yeah, it's very painful for them that they sort of feel like everyone in the world has benefited from these cells in some way, but they've actually suffered at the hands of them,
yeah,
at least emotionally.
More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca Skloot is our guest. And Rebecca is an award-winning science writer whose articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Oprah Magazine, Columbia Journalism Review. This book is going to be the big read for UW-Madison students next year. And as you heard Rebecca say, she'll be on campus to talk about it. And it's also going to be an HBO movie because Oprah is taking on this project along with some others, and Rebecca is going to be advising them. It is, and it's on the New York Times bestseller list and has been for, 15 weeks or something now. It's a fascinating read if you're just joining us on so many different levels, just the story of Henrietta Lacks and then the compelling story of her cells, the story of her family, the story of Black relationship with the medical community and the reasons for suspicion and all of that. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I wanted to tell you that tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour, Ed Schultz is going to be joining us from the Ed Show on MSNBC. He has a book. He's going to be in Madison, actually. He has a book, Ed Schultz, How Big Money and Bad Politics Are Destroying the Great American Middle Class. So that will be part of our first hour tomorrow. We are continuing our conversation with the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Jeff from Superior is our next caller. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for this topic. My thoughts and comment are more on a purely philosophical level. I have worked in the black community in Chicago for 11 years, and I know the contributions black people have made to this country, even though we're 200-some years old. So, I mean, I get emotional about the facts and the historical implications of what black people have done for us. But my thoughts on this level are, when you look at the philosophical, ethical questions of whether this is right or wrong or good or bad or whatever, recently I heard some church leaders say that, well, you know, we'll hold judgment as to whether it's good or bad or right or wrong, depending on what we do with the ethical breakthrough, you know, with the scientific breakthroughs. And I still think that we as human beings can judge things like this purely for what it is, whether it was right or wrong to exploit this woman's cells for the benefit of science. I don't think we need to wait for history to tell us what we did with it as to whether it was right or wrong. I still think the ends don't justify the means.
Rebecca.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is something that, in terms of science, we've grappled with that question. You know, what do you do with information that you get from research that was, you know, later determined to be ethical, not ethical? Yeah, this comes up with the Tuskegee study all the time. A lot, you know, they learned a lot about syphilis. Should we sort of, does that change anything? And, you know, I think often people, you know, are sort of able to separate that. You know, I think one of the things that's important about this story is people often look at this as a story of, you know, should they have taken this woman's cells and done things with them? And it's really hard to look at that from today's perspective, and sort of apply what we know about ethics and about science and about cells to that moment. You know, in the 50s when they took these cells, this was absolutely standard. They were taking cells from, you know, themselves, their kids, any of their patients, and trying to grow them. And they had no idea that, they didn't even know what DNA was. So they didn't know that someday you could look in these cells and learn about her kids or, you know, herself. Or, you know, there were a lot of things that they just couldn't have known at the time. And, you know, we didn't even have the term informed consent at that point. So it was a very different time, and I think it is important to look at it in that light. I think in this, with this story, where it gets a little trickier is in the 70s when the researchers went back to her kids and did research on them without informed consent. And that's where, you know, it gets much more complicated. I mean, we did have informed consent at that point, and, you know, there were practices of that. And so I think, and there are other moments in the story that were really sort of more sort of starkly ethically questionable, including, you know, her medical records were released at one point and published by a journalist without her family's knowledge. And so there are definitely moments in the story that we can look at and say, okay, even by the standards of the day, that was pretty, you know, that was pretty questionable. The moment that her cells were taken is actually, in some ways, the least controversial of them all, simply because of where, you know, what the standards of the day and the fact that there was no way they could have known that anything could have happened with those.
Well, and also, it was, if this hadn't worked out, or if it had just been a small success, the enormity of the scientific progress that was made because of her cells is really quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I think, you know, your caller did make an important point, which is that, you know, there are things, you know, it is important to look at the contributions as well as the way they were obtained in
right.
any science.
Right.
But yeah, it's true. I mean, they're so valuable for science. And her family has really gotten to the point, I mean, initially they were very angry about the cells being in existence and what was done with them, but they're incredibly proud of her cells now. They've really gotten to a point where they do believe that she was essentially chosen to come back to life as an angel in these cells and to help with all of these advances. And so for them, this is, you know, the cells are a wonderful thing. They have issues with the way that some of it was handled in terms of, you know, the research and the way that the family was treated, and the financial issues. But, you know, for them, the cells themselves, I think they wouldn't want anyone to say, you know, oh, we should essentially you know, dismiss some of the science that was done with these cells because of the ethical
right.
issues that the story raises. Because for them, that's, in a sense, that's the payoff. They're like, you know, yes, we struggled, she struggled. Look at all this good stuff that's happened. So for them, that's an important part of the story, too.
Right. And I'm interested in hearing more about your story because it really has been such a huge chunk of your life. Your learning, as you write early in the book, about the HeLa cells when you were 16 years old, I think, and taking a biology class at a community college.
Yeah, I did. And I had no intention of being a writer at that point. I was going to be a veterinarian. And, you know, I was in a basic biology class. It was one of these big sort of auditorium rooms with, you know, over 100 students in it. And my teacher said what most biology teachers say at some point, which is, you know, there are these cells. They've been alive since the 50s. They were, you know, this hugely important for science. And, you know, they're included in most basic biology classes. And my teacher, for somebody who knew her name, and he wrote it in big letters on the board, and he knew that she was black. And he said as much. And then that was it. And he erased the board, and class was over. And I went up to him after class, and I was like, well, who is she? And what else do we know about her? And did she have any kids? And what do they think of all this? And I was just filled with all these questions. And he said, sorry, we don't know anything. And you know, he said, you know, if you're curious, go see if you can, you know, do a little research, find some information, you know, write up a little paper. I'll give you some extra credit.
Right, write up a little paper.
And so, yeah, when the book was done, it was going through the production process. I tracked him down, and I sent him a copy of the manuscript of the book before it came out with a little note that, you know, dear Mr. Deffler, here's my extra credit project. You know, it's 20 some odd years late, but. You know, it just really, it stuck with me, and I think it did for a lot of different reasons. But I think, you know, it's funny, people, as I go and give talks and things about the book, people often say, well, what was it that grabbed you? Why? Like, you know, everybody hears about these cells, but why you? Like, why did you just sort of latch onto this? And I didn't really realize it until after the book was done and I was starting to talk about this, that the same time I learned about the cells when I was 16, my father was very sick. He had... He got a viral infection that caused some pretty severe brain damage.
Oh.
And, you know, he went from being sort of my dad, who was a marathon runner and this very fit young guy, to being completely incapacitated.
Oh.
He lost a lot of his memory. And he enrolled in a clinical trial, a drug study. And because of his brain damage, he couldn't drive. And so one of my chores as a teenager was, you know, drive dad to the hospital 4 times a week and sit with him while he would get these infusions of this experimental drug or maybe a placebo, we didn't know. And so I spent a lot of my 16th year at this research hospital, sitting in this large room. It was a solarium where people from lots of different studies would sit and get, you know, infusions or various treatments. You know, I'd do my homework there. And, you know, and I think, and one of my first questions when I heard about the cells was, did she have any kids and what did they think about this? And I think that's because I was a kid, you know, watching my father be, you know, used in research, you know, obviously with his consent and knowledge and everything. But, you know, and I think I was grappling with the emotions of that, you know, the excitement and the sort of hope that comes with it. Maybe they're going to fix him, and maybe they're going to figure out what's wrong with him. And then the, you know, the fear of what are they doing to him? And, you know, I think I was wrestling with all those issues in a way that made me immediately relate to her kids and want to know what they thought.
And what happened with your dad? Did he live much longer?
Yeah, he's still around. And,
he's still around now?
Yeah. He
is. Oh, that's wonderful.
He did, you know, he never went back to where he was before he got sick. He's been disabled ever since, but he's, you know, learned to live with his disabilities and has actually gone, he's also a writer, and he eventually went back to writing and has written a couple of books about living with brain damage. And so, yeah, he's doing well and enjoying this whole book process very much. He's the proudest father in the entire world.
Oh, I would imagine. As well he should be, because this is such an accomplishment. I mean, you've been able to take all this scientific information and make it accessible, but I love the stories, too, about, and we didn't even get to all of this, Henrietta's life and the men in her life and the poverty and who she married and why. That's a whole other, I'm amazed you could take all those stories and make a whole lot of it. You've done it just beautifully.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. All right, that's it. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book. I'm just delighted it's taken off for you. It's good.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Rebecca Skloot. You spell her last name S-K-L-O-O-T. The book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And we do want to give you this information, too. You can find, she talked about this foundation, which is really great, the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. So some of the proceeds from the sale of this book and then also from the HBO special that Oprah's working on will be donated to help out the family. And that's good. So if you want to just go to this, go to her website, Rebecca Skloot. rebeccasklot.com, and you can get all the information. And we also have an address, which we will put on our Facebook. And if you don't have computer access, give us a call and we'll give you the address of the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. Okay, that was interesting. I want to say thank you to Rhonda Fanning and thank you to Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks everybody for your calls. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.